Last month, we did a Please Explain segment on pain, so we thought that we would do a follow-up. And today's topic on Please Explain is pain medications. Barry Meyer, a reporter for the New York Times who focuses on the intersection of medicine, business, and public health, joins us now. He's been researching pain and pain medications for many years. His most recent publication is an e-book called A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake. We are pleased to welcome him to our show, and we invite our listeners to join in on the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692, write us on our show page at WNYC.org, or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Hi, Barry.
Hey, Leonard. How are you today?
I'm okay. Isn't analgesic the medical term for painkiller?
Yes, they're basically interchangeable. Something that is analgesic is basically the same as it's a painkiller.
Because it derives from the Greek without pain.
Exactly.
Now, are analgesics distinct from anesthetics?
Well, anesthetics are usually used in surgery. The person goes under, and the analgesic is basically a tablet that you take or a liquid that you take that works for a particular limited time that you don't need any fancy contraptions to use.
So they go to different parts of the central nervous system.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, let's just sort of walk slowly through the basic pain medications that most of your listeners use or are used to hearing about. So first you have medications that are known as NSAIDs or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. These are the most common class of pain drugs. That includes aspirin, ibuprofen, naproxen, the types of stuff that we typically take when we have a headache. You know, I painted the apartment this week. My muscles were sore, so I gobbled some naproxen to make myself feel better. Then about 20 years ago, we had the development of what were known as COX-2 inhibitors. And those are drugs that included Vioxx, Celebrex. Vioxx is no longer on the market, but Celebrex is. And they seem to offer an advantage over NSAIDs because basically NSAIDs inhibit an enzyme called cyclooxygenase. And cyclooxygenase comes in two forms, COX-1 and COX-2. COX-2 protects the digestive system, and COX-2 is created when there's pain in the joints. So NSAIDs inhibit both COX-1, COX-2, and the problem was that you would have gastrointestinal digestive bleeding if you take a lot of NSAIDs. So the idea was that we're going to come up with these specific drugs just to inhibit the COX-2 version of that particular enzyme.
Well, let me stop you there for a moment. Okay. One of the reasons that some people can't take aspirin, acetaminophen, is because of that kind of bleeding. But they
exactly.
take other NSAIDs as alternatives. So some cause COX-1 more than others?
Well, there's some suggestions to show that within that range of NSAIDs, that some of them may produce less intestinal bleeding than others. But they all sort of work the same way, so it's just a question of degree.
Now, why would intestinal bleeding be linked to pain killing?
Well, because this particular class of drugs inhibits both versions of the COX enzyme, both the COX-1 enzyme, which is the protective version of that enzyme, the one that protects your digestive system, and the COX-2 enzyme, which is the one that's associated with the sense of pain or is generated when joint irritation or joint pain exists. So if you're knocking out both those enzymes, you're essentially knocking out the enzyme that is protecting your digestive system as well as treating the pain. So that class of drugs does have that drawback to it.
Well, they reduce pain, but they also reduce inflammation, which seems like a positive thing.
Well, the pain is basically an expression of the inflammation. Mm-hmm. The inflammation occurs, then you start to feel pain. So that is basically what you're feeling when you're getting joint inflammation or muscle inflammation.
Now, some of these things, salicylates, for example, go all the way back to ancient times. The Greeks kind of knew about them. So are these really new drugs?
The entire class of painkillers are extremely old. Not only these more commonplace painkillers, but also the opioid or narcotic painkillers are extremely old drugs. They go back to ancient times. Opium was used in ancient times. Morphine was used in ancient time. The word morphine derives from the Greek god Morpheus, to sleep. So these drugs, be they over what we now describe as over-the-counter painkillers or prescription narcotics, have been around for thousands of years.
My guest is Barry Meyer, whose latest publication is a book called A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain, Medicine's Biggest Mistake. It's an e-book. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So when we have a pain and a doctor looks at it, what determines what the doctor tells us to take?
Well, a couple of things. So there are a few classifications of pain. There's what is known as acute pain. So acute pain is pain that typically lasts for a short period of time. It could be very intense pain, pain for following surgery, pain following an injury, everyday pain. So acute pain can come in a variety of strengths, but it's typically short-lasting. Chronic pain, which is the other major pain category, is pain, and again, from any variety of causes that could last 6 months or more. So you might have chronic pain from arthritis, from conditions like fibromyalgia, you may have chronic headaches that go on and on and on.
Sciatica.
Sciatica. So it depends on the type of pain that exists and how intensely you're feeling it. That will determine what the doctor gives you, if he gives you anything at all. And so, when pain is a very, very difficult condition for doctors to deal with, particularly long-lasting pain, it's very frustrating for them. They like the idea of giving patient medication. The patient improves. They go on their merry way. I mean, what they find very frustrating is conditions where patients' pain does not resolve itself in the amount of time they expect it to resolve. And often in those cases, they will, prescribe a very strong painkiller and then find that they keep prescribing more and more of it.
Now, you can buy some painkillers over the counter. Others must be prescribed. Is the reason that the ones that must be prescribed are not made available otherwise because they're stronger or because they're more likely to be addictive?
Typically, both those reasons. The ones that are prescription only tend to be stronger. And one of the downsides of the most powerful painkillers, the narcotic painkillers, is that they can be addictive or they can create other problems in patients. So these were about in the early 20th century. There was a law passed in the United States that began to tightly control how these drugs were prescribed by doctors. And, the use of these drugs in this country, particularly the strongest painkillers, have very much been governed by both our legalistic and moralistic views of drug addiction, of drug use, and the potential of these drugs to cause addiction.
You're right that the use of narcotic painkillers, the opioids, has boomed over the last decade, making them the most widely prescribed class of medications in the United States. So have we gotten past the moralistic aspects of the way we deal with opioids?
Well, we've certainly gotten far beyond it in many ways. I mean, this whole boom began about 20 years ago, it started out with the treatment of cancer pain. And 20, 30 years ago, many people who had cancer died very painful and unfortunate deaths because of these moralistic views that the use of painkillers would automatically lead to addiction.
So even though they were going to die soon, we were worried that they were going to die addicts rather than worrying about the pain they were going to have to contend with?
It's really quite remarkable, and it was really quite barbaric. And there were a lot of heroic doctors, including several here in New York City, that helped change the attitudes within the medical profession. Several of those doctors also then began to hypothesize that the same class of drugs could be useful in the treatment of chronic, long-lasting pain that was not related to cancer, that was caused by more common problems, you know, like back injuries or fibromyalgia or what have you. And they began to campaign, and drug companies also developed drugs, stronger narcotics at that time, to kind of change attitudes and views within the medical profession about narcotics and their ability to cause addiction.
Well, can we avoid being addicted if we are taking them for pain that is long-lasting?
Well, I guess what we've discovered over the last 10, 15 years is that the idea that these drugs could be prescribed widely and not produce either addiction or intense psychological dependency among the people who take them was sort of a false hope. There seems to be pretty substantial evidence that they do produce at least strong psychological dependency or drug-seeking behavior in a fairly significant portion of patients, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20% of the patients who are prescribed these drugs will then engage in what's known as drug-seeking behavior, which typically involves seeking more of the drug than they are prescribed.
Is OxyContin, which you have written about extensively, one of those drugs?
It definitely is. And OxyContin was sort of the drug that heralded in this whole new phase of pain drug use and pain treatment. It was the first long-acting concentrated version of a long-used narcotic called oxycodone. Oxycodone is the active ingredient in drugs like Percocet, but in those drugs, it existed in fairly small quantities and was mixed with over-the-counter medications like aspirin or acetaminophen. OxyContin was a pure version of oxycodone in very high doses because it was supposed to last 12 hours. It was in a time-released formula. So it kind of heralded the use of so-called long-acting single entity or single ingredient narcotics that kind of became the standard of care in the treatment of chronic pain.
But then it also became the kind of drug that people buy from drug pushers, the same people that they will go to for heroin or cocaine.
It very much,
as we discovered in the Rush Limbaugh case.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, it was right around that time. I was on your show about 10 years ago when my book Painkiller came out. And that's when the OxyContin boom was sort of happening, and Rush's problems were coming to the fore. And, you know, back at that time, there was still the idea that these drugs could be used safely within the medical sector, that there was a bright line that separated the sort of positive virtues of these drugs from their problems when they kind of jumped the medical fence and ended up on the street. But I think the trend that sort of occurred over the decades since then is the realization that these drugs, particularly if used over long periods of time and at high dosages, which they often are, can have very serious consequences for patients as well.
Now, is it safe to say that every one of these drugs, whether they are opioids or just simple the most simple analgesics, all have side effects of one sort or another?
Well, every drug has a side effect.
Negative side effects.
Yes. Well, most drugs do have negative side effects, and virtually every drug taken in excess will produce side effects. So things are often a trade-off between their benefits and their risks.
If you gobble down a lot of aspirin, for example, or a lot of Tylenol.
Exactly. I mean, if you gobble down a lot of Tylenol, you may end up with bleeding ulcers. And particularly if you're an old person, that could be a very, very serious problem. What we're seeing with the opioids is that along with the kind of known problem of addiction, there are other problems that are coming to the fore as well, including things like significantly reduced hormone production. You've probably seen all those ads on TV. If you watch TV about, low T, the guy's living in the shadows, he doesn't feel like he's up to his old self. That type of process is now apparent happens when people are on these opioid painkillers for a long time. Basically, their sexual hormones are driven down in men. Their testosterone is driven down, and this creates a tremendous amount of lethargy, lack of drive, what have you.
Now, those ads on television are always a bit shocking to me because as they show these people having a wonderful time, they're telling us that if we take the drug, there's a possibility that we will have suicidal thoughts, that we may have a heart attack or a stroke or whatever. But is it likely with the drugs we're talking about here?
I think there, with the opioid drugs, there are significant possibility of side effects. I mean, one of the problems is that, these drugs are being widely used in the treatment of chronic pain, that boom that began about 10, 15 years ago. But we really don't have any long-term scientific data on what happens to people that take these drugs for long periods of time. The longest study that's ever been run involving an opioid has lasted for 3 months. And some people are taking these drugs for years and years.
My guest is Barry Meyer, who writes for the New York Times. His latest book is an e-book called A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake. We'll be taking your calls and also reading your comments. After we take a little break, our phone number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, on Facebook as well, and on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Stay with us. And we are back with today's Please Explain Look at Painkillers with Barry Meyer of the New York Times. His latest publication is an e-book called A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter. On Twitter, our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Let's get to some of the calls. First, Deborah from New Rochelle. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I listen to this and I hear you talking about NSAIDs. And unfortunately, I had this experience of having to learn all of these acronyms because my daughter was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune disorder about 5 years ago. And what was frustrating to me is that her condition, when you read any of the medical literature, the first line of it says, the first line of treatment for treating this condition is an NSAID. So that you see these kids who are diagnosed with her condition receiving NSAIDs, which, and your comment about the NSAIDs treating the inflammation because pain is usually, they go hand in hand. Well, with her condition, something is causing that inflammation, meaning she gets lesions on her bones, which of course would cause inflammation and therefore pain in her joint. And when you look at the medical literature constantly repeating this refrain of the first line of treatment is an NSAID, it's never going after treating the condition itself. And the best medication for treating her condition has been a TNF blocker. And she's in remission and plays college tennis. Kids, though, who have a condition who are not, where the doctors see that or the insurance companies see that medical literature, are being treated with things like, Celebrex and all of those things that go after the pain, but don't go after the condition. And it's very frustrating when you to hear about these other children who aren't having the great results that my daughter did.
Now, Barry, I think what the caller is saying is that all of these painkillers are really masking the pain, but they're not solving not going after the cause of the pain.
That's absolutely right. And that's what they do. They basically mask or relieve the pain. And when they wear off, the pain returns and you're required to take more of them. Your caller speaks to a broader point, and that is, you know, shouldn't doctors be looking at the cause of pain, treating the cause of pain? And while we're speaking largely about medications, there's, you know, evidence to show that other ways of treating pain, even serious chronic pain, are just as effective as these strong opioid painkillers.
Thank you so much for your call. We go now to Dora from Oceanside, Long Island. Hi, Dora. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My name is Dora. I'm a pharmacist on Long Island. I work at a specialty store that we actually specialize in chronic disease state management, and we deal with a lot of pain management patients. We see hundreds of prescriptions a day for opioids, and we're having a very big problem on Long Island in general with, you know, short-acting oxycodone. We get prescriptions for oxycodone, 30 milligrams, day in, day out. And I was wondering if the guest had any pointers for a pharmacist, you know, any kind of guidelines to help determine, you know, which prescriptions are legitimate, because obviously pain management is a real field of medicine, and there are people in real pain that require help. But unfortunately, we also see all these doctors left and right being arrested for running pill mill operations where they're selling prescriptions. And it's not always so easy to distinguish between the patients who need the medication and the patients who are either abusing or selling the medication. I was wondering if he had any kind of pointers, guidelines, recommendations for a pharmacist, you know, to be able to dispense responsibly.
Barry?
Well, I don't have recommendations, but I can say that this is a big dilemma both for pharmacists and for patients, legitimate patients, that is, making sure that the right drugs get to the right people. As to your comments about oxycodone, just so the listeners understand, oxycodone is the active ingredient, the narcotic that's found in drugs like OxyContin and Percocet, and when law enforcement and other folks became aware of problems with OxyContin, there was a big boom in the prescribing of oxycodone pills, the type of 30 milligram doses that the caller is speaking about. And down in Florida, for example, where there are literally hundreds of sort of ersatz pain clinics that were really pill mills, this was the prescription of choice.
Now,
they were basically, yeah, go ahead.
Finish your thought.
I was basically saying that became the replacement for OxyContin, that became the hot street drug, were these 30 milligram oxycodone tablets.
Well, that suggests that these people are not taking it for pain, but they're taking it to get high, right?
I'm not saying that there are people who are not taking.
But some people are taking it as a recreational drug. Otherwise,
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Is it all that different from methamphetamines?
Well, it's a different class of drugs. It's a narcotic, it is a drug that became a popular drug of abuse. There are many people who are taking that drug legitimately, so the fact that a doctor is prescribing this drug isn't determinative of whether someone is abusing it or not abusing it. I'm just pointing out that that has become the popular prescription. Mm-hmm. That is often found in the hands of someone who's posing as a pain patient.
Yes,
or that's been being written by a doc who's posing as a pain management specialist.
Yes, the detectives that we deal with, you know, on a fairly regular basis tell us that, I mean, a pill like an oxycodone 30, which costs our pharmacy roughly 30 cents, you know, and we can dispense at a cash price of, you know, just a couple of dollars, can go on the street, at least on Long Island, for $30, $40 a tablet. So, you know, just dispensing one of these medications, you know, one prescription, if it gets into the wrong hands, can end up on the black market and, you know, be illegally worth, I don't know, thousands of dollars. It's crazy.
Dora, thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you. Bye.
The same is true of the opiates, right? That they, on the one hand, they can cover pain, deal with pain, but on the other hand, people take them to get high. They make you feel good.
Absolutely. That has been with the issues surrounding these drugs all along. And it just, you know, morphs over time. Sometimes it's a drug like OxyContin, as your caller pointed out just now. What she's seeing is prescriptions for a drug like oxycodone. All these drugs are in the same class of drugs. They have the same pain-killing properties, and they also have the same properties for abuse and for addiction.
Antonio from Bayside left this question on our show page. He says, I'm a runner. I notice my recent chronic neck pain seems to get better with exercise. Is there any research in regard to bottle or replicate that good feeling I get from the exercise? Is he getting the natural painkiller that the body creates, endorphins?
You know, exercise works for a lot of people for relieving pain. You know, people do yoga for pain. People do various exercise for pain. Exercise is a wonderful thing. And when people go into, you know, programs that are designed to help them with very serious pain, with chronic pain conditions, physical therapy and exercise are fundamental parts of that program, because it's not just treating pain that should be the goal of any pain treatment. It should be increasing the physical mobility, the physical function of the patient's body. They can do more. They can you know, do the types of activities that they were able to do or get close to doing that activity before they incurred the pain. And most of our treatment in recent years has only been aimed at dealing with the pain, not improving the physical function of the patient.
Doesn't the body create painkillers? I mentioned endorphins, as I understand it. Whenever we have a really terrible pain and then suddenly it goes away because we have to function, it's because endorphins are at work. There are receptors in the brain, the same receptors that that opiates wind up going to.
Exactly.
So we're creating opiates in our body?
We're creating, you know, things that block the pain, and but unfortunately they wear off. So the question is, you know, once, you know, you have a bad accident, you're in shock, you're not feeling any pain, but in an hour or two, you're going to feel significant pain. So, you know, we need medications to deal with the afterwards.
Let's take another call. This one is Stuart from Brooklyn. Hi, Stuart. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. I was recently diagnosed with osteoarthritis in my left knee. I was prescribed diclofenac misopro 75-0.2 TB, and I was prescribed one tablet twice a day. Now, I also have pre-existing stomach issues. My first question is, I do find difficulty in taking it. I know I have to take it with food. It causes some discomfort. And without my doctor's approval, I reduced to taking it one a day. I have noticed improvement. I don't feel pain in my knee as long as I take it every day.
And so what is your question?
My question is,
keeping in mind that Barry is not a doctor.
My question is, do I have to take these pills every day or only when I feel pain?
Barry, I suspect that's something he should see a doctor about.
Yeah, I'm going to defer to your doctor about that, other than to say that, you know, diclofenac is within the class of NSAIDs, and it may be one of the better NSAIDs when it comes to creating or avoiding the types of gastrointestinal problems that other NSAIDs can produce.
That's probably why his doctor prescribed it.
Possibly, yes.
Let's take another call. Nancy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My name is Nancy Rosenzweig. I'm a certified nurse midwife, and this is more of a comment than a question, although I'd love to hear Barry's comment. I'm constantly appalled by the number of women who show up pregnant on antidepressants, anti-anxiety, anti-pain medications, already addicted to all of the above, and think that there are no side effects and no risks.
Nancy, are you talking about them early stages of pregnancy or later?
Yes.
When they may very well be experiencing pain as a result of the pregnancy?
No. This is people entering a pregnancy already addicted to many types of pain medications.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are told by doctors not to drink wine or any alcoholic beverages while they're pregnant. Wouldn't doctors also tell them not to take these drugs?
No, because there are dangers in withdrawal that have major consequences for both the pregnant woman and the fetus.
Well, I'm pretty much out of time, unfortunately, so I guess we're not going to resolve that problem. But there are people who wonder whether taking pain medication affects your tolerance. If you take it for a long time, do you develop some kind of tolerance to pain medications, Mary?
Well, tolerance is a very natural result of taking prescription opioids. It's a sort of natural physical thing that happens. The problem is, with tolerance, you get a reduction in the pain-killing effect of the drug. So a patient who's, say, been on 100 milligrams of a drug successfully will suddenly feel that they're feeling pain again.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank
okay.
you so much, Barry Meyer.
My pleasure, Leonard.
The latest book, an e-book, A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake. Thank you all who have called in. Katharina Witt was the top international figure skater in the 1980s when she represented East Germany. On Monday's show, she describes how she was also under constant surveillance by the Stasi. She's joined by the directors of a new documentary about dealing with the unusual convergence of sports and politics. And then Tom Donahue on his new documentary about the unsung hero in filmmaking, The Casting Director. We'll also find out how posting calorie counts on menus really affect our diet choices. And a psychiatrist talks about the patients who have challenged her and ultimately deepened her commitment to her work. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Drew Corcoran, Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Darcher is at the audio controls. We had help today from Helen Rauner and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.